I'm going to talk tonight about Romans chapter 1, verses 18 through 32. I thought I'd tell you why it is that I happen to be speaking on this passage tonight. When I go to the Word of Life Bible Institutes, it's quite common that they say, would you be willing to speak or give a sermon on Sunday morning? And I say I will. And it's actually a relatively, not as time consuming as it might be some places, because if you give us a talk or a sermon in Korea and then you do it in Hungary, you don't really have to worry about, you know, people hearing the same message twice. So I go through it, try to make it appropriate for that audience, but I do the same thing. But this was a little different in Hungary. He said, will you know, speak on Sunday morning? And I said, yes. And then 2 days later, he called back and said, by the way, this is the passage you're going to be speaking on. And I said, oh, really? Okay. And it turned out that what they do is they go through a book of the Bible, but they have the teachers that are coming in address each section, or maybe somebody there does. So I agreed, and I kind of got ready to speak on Romans 1. And then I got there on a Saturday night, and I got up Sunday morning, and I showed up, and I walked through the door, and the guy saw me, and he kind of got a blank look, and he said, are you scheduled to speak this morning? And I said, yes. And he said, there's been a mix-up. We're actually not on your passage, we're on another passage, and we've got somebody else who's going to speak. So I said, that's fine, and it was wonderful. They probably were more edified hearing him than they would have if they'd have heard me, and I was edified, so it was fine. But when I got back, I told Dan the story, and I said, so if you ever have an opening and you're looking for someone, I'm all dressed up and know where to go. So Dan asked me if I would speak tonight, and in the end, I don't think he asked me because I'm doing a favor for him. I think he was probably doing a favor for me, so thank you, Dan, for that. So, we're at Romans 1, 18 through 32, and I thought, let's just read through it for starters. Verse 18, for the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness, because that which is known about God is evident within them, for God made it evident to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes, his eternal power and divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made, so that they are without excuse. For even though they knew God, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, and their foolish heart was darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and exchanged the glory of the incorruptible God for an image in the form of corruptible man and of birds and of four-footed animals and crawling creatures. Therefore, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity, so that their bodies would be dishonored among them. For they exchanged the truth of God for a lie and worshipped and served the creature rather than the Creator, who is blessed forever. Amen. For this reason, God gave them over to degrading passions, for their women exchanged the natural function for that which is unnatural. In the same way also, the men abandoned the natural function of the woman and burned in their desire toward one another, men with men committing indecent acts and receiving in their own persons the due penalty of their error. And just as they did not see fit to acknowledge God any longer, God gave them over to a depraved mind to do those things which are not proper, being filled with all unrighteousness, wickedness, greed, evil, full of envy, murder, strife, deceit, malice. They are gossips, slanderers, haters of God, insolent, arrogant, boastful, inventors of evil, disobedient to parents, without understanding, untrustworthy, unloving, unmerciful. And although they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things are worthy of death, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. I've got a handout, and it kind of shows the way I'm going to approach this passage. Six different parts. The first is just verse 18, the wrath of God is revealed, which, as I see it, is sort of the summary statement of what this passage is about. This is about the wrath of God being revealed. And what follows that then, as I see it, are four phases, I'm going to call them, of the revelation of God's wrath. The first is, men know God. Take a look there at verses 19 to 21. That theme comes up again and again. Starting in verse 9, I'm kind of hitting those spots. That which is known about God is evident within them. God made it evident to them. His invisible attributes, have been clearly seen, being understood. And then in the first part of 21, they knew God. Again and again, the basic idea there is men know God in some way. The second phase I've called there for the second part of 21 through 23 is men became fools. And how that works is there in 21 it says, they did not honor him as God or give thanks, but they became futile in their speculations, their foolish heart was darkened, they became fools, and they exchanged the glory of God for an image. So the second phase, so one, men know God, two, they don't honor or thank him, and they become fools. And then the third stage, the third phase of this wrath of God is that God gives men over, and that's repeated three times in that section, 24 to 31. Verse 24, God gave them over in the lusts of their hearts to impurity. Verse 26, God gave them over to degrading passions. Verse 28, God gave them over to a depraved mind. So the third phase is God gives them over. And then finally, briefly at the end in verse 32, what I've called miserable men love company, that comes from the phrase misery loves company, that these men who have been through this, there at the end of 9:32, not only do they do these things, but they give hearty approval to those who practice them. So we're going to go over the introductory sentence and then the introduction that the wrath of God is revealed, talk about each of those four phases, and then, time permitting, I'm going to do what I think is sort of a brief application of this passage to modern times, to the world that we live in today. So, we'll begin with verse 18. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth and righteousness. I think one of the best ways of seeing and understanding this is to look back at the previous verse, verse 17. My Bible has a heading right in there that kind of breaks it up, but they're closely tied together. Look at verse 17. For in it the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. The it is the gospel. If you back up to verse 16, it says, for I am not ashamed of the gospel, for it is the power, and so forth. So the it is the gospel. So it's saying, for in the gospel the righteousness of God is revealed from faith to faith. To make the sentence fit a little more parallel with the next one, I'm going to take that prepositional phrase in the gospel and put it after and read 17 this way. For the righteousness of God is revealed in the gospel from faith to faith. Then when you read 18, it reads in a very parallel manner. The wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness. So in 17, we have the righteousness of God is revealed. In 18, we have the wrath of God is revealed. You know, in the Psalms, parallelism is quite common. You'll see, you'll take two passages, and the writer will say essentially the same thing two times in a row, and by looking at them and comparing them, you'll have a better understanding of the concept he's trying to convey. Or he may say two things that are the opposite. I think there's something of that going on here. In 17, we have men of faith. We have the righteousness of God being revealed in the gospel, the salvation of men of faith. And in contrast with that, in verse 18, we have men who suppress the truth. They have no faith, they suppress the truth, and the wrath of God is revealed against all of their ungodliness and righteousness. And those two verses together sort of sum up the world, isn't it? There is suppressing the truth and suffering the wrath of God. There is faith in Jesus Christ and salvation in the gospel. That's pretty much a summary of those two things. And the second one is the topic of this passage, the revelation of the wrath of God. Before we go a lot further with that, we'll go to my second question. Is God mean? Okay. The very concept, when you say wrath of God, with a lot of people and all of us to one degree or another have a little bit of a reaction of wrath. Is God like cruel? Is he mean and vindictive? That's kind of the images that come to our mind when we see the word wrath. And here's the problem as I see it. God is a person. He's three persons in one person. That's not the topic here. So I'm just going to say God is a person, okay? God is a person, and he's described throughout the Bible as a person. And he's described with attributes that we see in human beings. Love, jealousy, justice, regret. There's one. That's one that's always puzzled me. How does God have regret? But at times we see God with regret. So the problem is when we're trying to understand God and he's being described with these human attributes, when we experience those human attributes in our day-to-day life, every time we see them in other people, they're perverted. They're never quite what they should be. Okay? That doesn't seem to cause us so much problem with love. When there's a parent whose love for his child gets out of hand and it causes the parent to do something, we don't say, oh, God doesn't love, because we see parents in their love doing things that are bad. We say, that's just not the right kind of love. That's not God's love. But we are tempted sometimes when we see wrath to think of all the nastiness that can come with wrath, and we have this temptation to think, that's not God. God doesn't have wrath. And in its extreme, we see that in our culture. Well, in the end, God accepts everyone. There are lots of paths to God. You know, when you go down that road, the danger is in distinguishing between man's wrath and God's wrath, we dismiss the idea of God's wrath. And that's a mistake. I was reading through Leviticus 26. I was thinking about reading it tonight. I'm not going to, but God explains what he's going to do if they disobey him. And I finished the chapter, and I'm like almost exhausted thinking, wow, the wrath of God is a ferocious thing. It's an incredibly ferocious thing. I think about, where have we seen human wrath that is God-like? I think of Jesus in the temple, cleansing the temple. We tell stories about where Jesus shows compassion and love, and we see how people are attracted to him, and we identify with that. If we apply that to the cleansing of the temple, I think the cleansing of the temple must have been a terrifying thing to see. The pure wrath of God was being revealed. In a small way, I compare it to if I had a teacher or a coach who was just always nasty, you kind of got used to it. But when there was a teacher or a coach who was kind and understanding, and then someone crossed a line and they kind of went off, that's terrifying. And I think at the extreme, when Jesus is in the temple exercising the wrath of God and judgment in a way, and what's going to happen, that's a terrifying thing. The other example I come to think of it is the wrath of man is like when you're building a fire in your backyard. You've got a bunch of old, rotten, wet wood and trash, and so you start this fire. And it kind of burns, but it's not burning real hot, and there's lots of smoke and smell, and it's an ugly thing. Okay? That's the wrath of humans. It's impure, and it gives off all of this junk and nastiness, and it has an odor, and it doesn't burn as hot as you'd like. Whereas the wrath of God is like pure methane and oxygen being lit. It emits no impurities. It's just carbon dioxide and water, and it burns hotter and more furiously than that other fire does. So the thing is to keep in mind as you think about God's wrath, no, it's not like human wrath. It doesn't have any of the impurities. But because of that, don't think that it's not as intense. It's far more intense. It's more intense than anything we can imagine. So that's the introduction in verse 18 to the wrath of God. And now we move on to what I call the first phase of the revelation of the wrath of God. I mentioned those four times where Paul reveals that men know God. And I'd like to focus on a couple of things there, just a couple particular questions that maybe help us to see that even clearer. The first is the question, what does the word because explain? The word because at the beginning of verse 19. To explain that, suppose you're in a catechism kind of class and the teacher says, why is the wrath of God revealed? And a student raises his hand and says, because that which is known about God is evident within the men against whom he's revealing his wrath. You say, good answer, okay? What would that mean then? What we're saying is there's an implicit thing in there. God isn't revealing wrath against men because they understand the truth. He's revealing wrath against them because they've rejected the truth. The comment that it's being revealed because they knew it is justifying what God is doing. It's explaining why God would do it. If the parent says to the child, you're grounded, you knew the curfew was 11 o'clock. You're not grounding the child because he knew that it was 11 o'clock. You're saying, I'm grounding you because you broke the curfew, and I'm justified in it because you knew it. If you didn't know it, I might not have exercised my wrath. So that's one way of looking at that word, because. But there's another one. Suppose someone asks the question, why do men suppress the truth in unrighteousness? And the answer could be, because that which is known about God is evident within them. It could be answering a different question. And let me explain how it would be answering that question. The best example I can come up with is, think about an alcoholic. I'm going to use this example a lot tonight. There's an alcoholic, his drinking is out of control, it's destroying his marriage, it's messing up his job, it's deteriorating his health, it's just really messing him up. Okay? He knows it. He knows it better than anybody else does. Do alcoholics go around saying, yep, my drinking is messing me up, it's messing up my marriage, but I'm going to keep doing it. No, what do they do? You know, Bill, your drinking is messing up your marriage. Ah, no, it's really her fault. She's got all these problems. They deny the truth, okay? He suppresses the truth. And why does he suppress it? Because he knows it and he can't deal with it, so he suppresses it. And I think the because there may be going to, why do men suppress the truth? Because they know it. They know it and they know they've rejected it and they don't want to deal with the fact that they've rejected God. That's a heavy thing to deal with. So what they do is they suppress the truth. God really doesn't care if I do that. There isn't even a God. God's just, you know, God loves everybody and so forth. I mean, you know the arguments, right? Men suppress the truth because the truth, really facing up to the truth that there is a God, is a frightening thing, and so they suppress it. From what I can tell, the commentators I've read, most of them would say it's the first. A few say it's the second. I guess maybe it's the second. I don't know. I'll just leave it to you for your consideration. The second thing I'd like to look at in this first phase of the wrath of God is revealed, that men know God, is this: how can the invisible be seen? Look down there in verse 20. It says, God's invisible attributes have been clearly seen. I've left out his eternal power and divine nature just to get the heart of the matter. His invisible attributes have been clearly seen. On the face of it, the most simple, direct way of looking at it, that sentence is nonsense, right? What's the definition of something that's invisible? It's something that can't be seen. So Paul's saying something that can't be seen is seen. That doesn't make any sense, right? So our choice is Paul is talking nonsense or he's making another point. And I think we don't have any problem seeing what that other point is. When he says it's been seen, it means it's understood. But I think even by using the word seen, he is emphasizing the clarity of how well it is seen. He says clearly seen, but it also emphasizes it. I think I can illustrate that with another maybe point. When I'm teaching math or maybe explaining a legal thing to some clients, suppose it's a math thing and I've got the equations up on the board, or it's a memo and the client's looking at it, they will look at it and they'll say, you know, I understand, but, and they'll explain a problem. And I understand, and I'll explain something and say, yeah, I understand, but. And then eventually when the light bulb goes off and something clicks, and we've all had this experience, what do you say when that happens? You say, I see it. We have the phrase, seeing is believing. The idea that we see something is stronger even than the idea that we understand it or that it's in our head. And I think that's the point of this. It's these invisible attributes are as clear to us as if we could just see them in front of us, like you're sitting in front of me. That's how clearly we see it, which is a pretty strong idea, isn't it? The idea that men know God, men really do know God. It's being stated very clearly. So that takes us then to the second phase of the wrath of God is revealed. And that is, and so that starts in 21b. It starts because they don't honor or glorify him as God or give thanks. But in alternative to that, they become futile in their speculations, their foolish hearts darkened, and they become fools. I've summarized that as just men become fools. And my first question then here, what I'd like to talk about, is how or why is foolishness the alternative to honoring God? In its purest sense, you honor or give thanks, you dishonor and you take credit yourself. That would be the clearest juxtaposition, the opposite. How is it that becoming a fool is the alternate to honoring God? Here's my explanation of what I think is going on in that passage there. Theoretically, let's imagine someone who doesn't honor God and give thanks to him, but he doesn't become foolish. He still sees things clearly. And he says, I see the invisible attributes of God. I acknowledge them. I know his eternal power, and I know his divine nature. And if we go ahead and jump way ahead to verse 32, and I know the ordinance of God, that disobeying him makes me worthy of death. I know all those things. I clearly see them. And I've decided to reject God and take eternal damnation. I'm going to be clear-minded about this. That's what I'm going to do. Okay? People don't do that. People don't do that. They know it. Now, they know God, and they know his commands, and they reject him. They don't honestly stand up and say what they're doing. What they do is they start to rationalize. They take something that they know to be absolute truth, the absolute truth of the universe, and they start to rationalize and come up with explanations that are, in the end, futile and foolish. Because facing up to the actual truth of where they are is just something they're not going to do. When the student comes in and he hasn't done his homework, he says, "The dog ate my homework," right? He doesn't just stand there and say, "Didn't do it." He says, "The dog ate my homework." And everybody knows the dog didn't eat the homework, and it's foolish. But that's what he says. And that's a simple example, but I think we can all identify with it. We do it sometimes, and we have the urge, don't we? When the truth is right there and it's plain, we avoid it. And so when the ultimate truth of God is known to men and they're rejecting it and they know they're rejecting it, the alcoholic will come up with preposterous explanations for what he's doing rather than face up to the truth. Which brings me to an interesting point from this, and I've raised it as a question of how do I share the gospel with a fool? I've thought about this in my life is that, you know, when you're talking to a non-believer, there's at least two different kinds of conversations you can be having. And the one is, and I don't think I ever really grasped this one well enough, is when the person is saying there is no God, when he denies that God gives commands and he's not following those commands and he's worthy of judgment, when the person is saying that, he's speaking foolishness. He's being a fool and he's speaking nonsense. How do you speak to a fool? I think you can mess up two ways. I do both regularly. The first is, you just insult them, right? You just make them feel like an idiot. You say, "You're a fool," and that's the quickest way of doing it. Or sometimes even they take a couple of positions and you just point the arrow at them and you treat them like an idiot. And pretty soon, they're hostile to me because I've just been insulting them and calling them a fool. And they're not getting to the truth of God at all. All they can see is, here's a person that's calling me a fool. So that's the first way I can mess up when I'm talking to that person. The second way I can mess up is to engage them, right? And I've been in those conversations where someone's giving all these arguments about how there isn't a God or these arguments that deny the basic truths about God that they know, and I'm halfway into the discussion and I realize, you know, by continuing to engage this person, I'm encouraging them. When you're with the alcoholic, and he's denying all of these things and is saying, giving all these reasons, the things, the problems with his wife and all these other things, and you discuss them and try to go through each one and rationally discuss each one with him, at some point, you're actually encouraging him because he's going, "Hey, you know what? I don't believe it, but he's starting to believe it. Maybe there is something to it." You can actually encourage them. And at some point with the alcoholic, you have to say, listen, Harvey, you know what the truth is. You know what the problem is. When you're ready to deal with it, let's talk. And I think it's some way that way with the gospel. If the person is just completely denying God and you're trying to get them to the gospel, at some point you need to say, "You know what, Harvey? You're a sinner. You know it. You know there's a God. And if you're not willing to acknowledge that, I'm not really sure there's a whole lot further we can go in this conversation." Contrast that with the person who does say, "Yeah, there is a God. There is a God, and I'm in trouble, and I don't know what to do about it." Then you're explaining something to them. Now you're talking about something they really don't know. It's foolishness to them. They don't understand it. And that's when you can explain, because they don't know about the grace that's offered through Jesus Christ, and that's something you can explain to them. You don't need to explain to them that there's a God. They know it. You might be an instrument of God to provoke them to acknowledge it, but you don't have to explain it. They know it. They're fools. You treat a fool respectfully, but don't forget that he's a fool. That brings us over to the third phase that I've called it of the wrath of God is revealed and that God gives men over. Three times it says it. And so the question I have for that is, are we estranged from God because of our sinful acts, or do we commit sinful acts because we are estranged from God? I think if you ask most people and said, tell me something about the wrath of God, how does it come about, what is it? If you could engage, most people probably would say you're nuts and not talk to you. But to the extent they would, I think they would say, well, I get tempted and I do bad things, and because I do bad things, I'm estranged from God and God puts his wrath on me. Okay? I think that's probably the way most people think. But I look at this passage and it doesn't seem to be describing it that way. People have, it says, man does not honor God or give thanks. At some basic level, man is rejecting what he knows about God. And that's all that's happened at this point. They become foolish. And then, therefore, because they have become foolish, because they've rejected God and become foolish, God gives them over to this sinful acts. Okay? Now, this is not, there's more to it than that. The Bible also describes when we do sinful acts, that separates us from God. But of course, and then we get separated from God and he turns us over to more sin. And this whole passage is describing kind of a downward spiral. I sin, that distances me further from God, so he hands me over further, so I do more sin, and down and down and down it goes. But in sort of a chicken or egg kind of thing, which came first, this seems to be saying that at the core level, the problem initially is we've turned away from God, and because of that, the sinful acts follow, which is different than most people think about it. What this seems to be saying is the only thing that's keeping us from sinning is God. And then he turns us over to it. Okay. The implications are huge. If, in fact, we do bad things, we're estranged from God, God's wrath comes about us, how can we fix that situation? Well, we quit doing bad acts. We start doing good acts. And when we do enough good acts, then God won't be wrathful toward us anymore. That's the solution. But if the problem is we have turned from God, and now God has turned us over to these bad acts, what do we do? Apparently, we don't have the power to change the bad acts. If we do the bad acts because we're estranged from God, we have to get right with God first, and then he will protect us from those bad acts. The first thing that has to happen is we get right with God. If we were initially separated because we rejected God, now we got the additional problem that he's turned us over to sin. Now, not only do I have to, again, honor and thank God, I got to make up for these other sins. And the question the person's going to ask, if you're right that the order is different, how can I get back to God? If I can't do it through my good acts, how can I get back to God? Anybody in this room have the answer to that? It's the gospel of Jesus Christ. We have faith. And when we have faith, then he will begin protecting us from our sin. Okay? I'd like to, at that point then, to jump down to C there, because there's a problem then when I see that. You know, I'm trusting that everybody in this room wants to honor God and gives him thanks and does honor him and give him thanks. But in my case, as I read through this long list of sins, I see a lot of myself in it. Okay? I see a lot of myself in it. And when I think about the Sermon on the Mount where Jesus says, murder means if you're angry with someone, you're guilty of murder. If I set that same kind of standard up for all these others, go down the list. It's me. Okay, so what's the problem here? I'm trying to honor God. I want to give thanks to him. But this is part of my life. So what's the deal? What's going on? And I think the brief explanation I would give to that, to someone who asked that question, is we come into this world not honoring God and not giving him thanks. That is the default human condition. And we all, at some point, have started down that downward spiral. That downward spiral of God hands us over to sin, so we sin, that separates us further from God. He hands us over to more sin, and down we go. I also pray that everyone, and trust that everyone in this room, though, has been delivered from that through faith in Jesus Christ. And so here's an example I'm working on. Later on, tell me if this works in a class. I've used this one before. Here is our guilt, our legal status before God. And here is the life that we lead. Okay? Before Christ, we are 100% guilty. 100% guilty. And we are 100% self-absorbed, sinful creatures. We have nothing for God. We come to faith, and this meter right here immediately goes from 100% guilty to 100% innocent. We are right before God. We are in relationship with Him, and that will never, ever, ever change. We know it. That's rock solid. We are with Him. We are forever with Him. What about this side? Does it just jump right up here? Does it jump right up with the other one? All of a sudden, we're leaving completely unselfish lives, entirely focused on God, no sin at all, no sinful acts. No, at least in my life, this is what happened. This one all the way up here, and this one right here, it quivers, it bounces, but it's moving up. It's moving up. This spiral we were all in, we are forgiven, we are with Him, but coming out of that spiral is going to take the rest of our lives. But we know there will become a day when this side's going to be up here too. And that's where we're going to be for eternity, when we're finally, finally delivered from the effects of sin. And we're finally freed from that. Why this emphasis on sexual immorality? You look from verse 26 to 27, the thing that God has handed them over to, it's a description of sexual immorality. 28 through 31 is everything else. And on my Bible, if I kind of measure them, they're about equal. So why is there this emphasis on sexual immorality? I think we can see it in our culture today. Sin is always a perversion of something good. Okay? Sex is a good thing as God designed it. Between a man and a woman and procreation, that's a good thing. Man takes it and turns it away and it becomes a bad thing. Okay? Love of your family is a good thing. When it causes you to go out and you pervert it and you steal or you mistreat other people to protect your children, that's sin. So there's always this, all of our sinful acts tend to be a perversion. We were created in God's image. Our sin is a perversion of that image in some way or another. Sex, procreation is one of the most powerful things in us. And I think the idea is, if one of the most powerful things in us can be corrupted, that's the most evil sin. If you can take that most powerful urge in somebody and turn it in a wrong direction, and you look at our culture today, and I think you see that, maybe more than others. Tens of millions of unborn babies killed. And why are they killed? Because people want to be free to have sex with who they want to have sex with, when they want to, and not be responsible for it. We see an AIDS epidemic. I was looking the other day, transgenderism becoming popular. I can't vouch for this for sure, but suicide rates among transgender people are outrageously high. So what happens is we see this, if you can turn something as powerful as sex to the evil side, it is a great evil. And so maybe when you look at our culture today, particularly, it makes sense why Paul would put an emphasis on that. The fourth phase is, I've labeled the miserable men love company, that's in verse 32. Before he actually gets to the fourth phase, he kind of goes back and reviews the first one, men know God, and makes it even stronger and says, they know the ordinance of God, that those who practice such things, these evil acts, are worthy of death. So it's again, it's a kind of going back and emphasizing, men know God, they really do. People know what they're doing when it's wrong. They lie about it, they suppress it, but they know it. And then he finishes this section with, they not only do the same, but also give hearty approval to those who practice them. Some verses in the Bible, I see it, I struggle with it, it doesn't make sense, and so forth. And then there are some that when I read them, it's just like, wow, whoever wrote this knows people. And this is one of those for me. Let's go back to my example of the alcoholic. What does an alcoholic really, really like? Someone to sit down and have a drink with him, right? Someone who will sit down with him because it makes him feel better about himself. He'll give hearty approval to someone who will sit down and have a drink with him. What does he think about the person who's sitting there and he says, hey, you want a drink? And the person says, I'll have a Coke. It irritates him to no end. I think we've all been a part of that. I think of it like in the schoolyard. You know, when the kids are up to trouble, you know, and the one kid says, think about a gang or a club, a serious gang. How do you get in? You go commit a crime. If it's a really serious gang, you go kill somebody, then we'll let you in and we will approve you. You win our approval by engaging in the kind of things that we do. That is a very basic human behavior. And I've been on both sides. I think we all have, where stand up and do the right thing and you're not a popular person, but probably just as often I've more often maybe. I've been in the situation where I'm doing something I know I shouldn't be doing, and there's that annoying person who doesn't go along, and it drives you nuts, doesn't it? It's your conscience, and it's really a blessing. It's a good thing. But that's what that verse is talking about. Misery loves company. I'm a wretched person lost in my sin. At least give me someone who will engage in it with me. That's what I want. And that's kind of the spiral of Romans 8, 1 through 23. I'd like to finish by kind of applying that to modern times. And by modern times, I'm talking about maybe the last 100 years or so. There's a book called Modern Times by a man named Paul Johnson. If you've read it, you're going to probably say, Jack, you stole that from Paul Johnson, so I'm giving my disclosure right now. It's not directly taken from him, so if I mess it up, that's my fault. But if it's good, it probably comes from him. And he's written a book about the last 100 years or so, and his thesis is there was a way of thinking that was developing in the late 1800s, represented by these four people I've listed here. And then World War I happened, and government institutions were shattered. People lost faith in all institutions, including the church and so forth, and so there's this rubble. And what comes out of it is this thinking from these people from the late 1800s. And it leads, and that explains what we've seen in the last 100 years, which is not pretty. The first person he mentions is Marx. Marx is an atheist. Marx says, I'm not going to honor God, I'm not going to give thanks to him. And then he says, what happens when you don't honor and give thanks to God? You become foolish. Marx says, but I have figured out the world. It's really just about economic interests. And you know, we could design a system where everybody has the same amount of stuff and we all get along and the world is peaceful and wonderful. Foolishness. Look at the last 100 years. Look at the economy. Look at Russia. Look at China. Look at Cuba. Look at Venezuela. The ideas of Karl Marx are absolute foolishness. And they have to be because they come out of a lack of faith in God. And they're not just foolish then. God turns those places over to that foolishness. They turn Russia over to that foolishness, and tens of millions of people are slaughtered. Tens of millions of people are slaughtered by famine. They're killed in political prison camps. It's a terrible horror. Germany, it ends up in a Holocaust with 6 million Jews killed. Sigmund Freud was also an atheist. But unlike Marx, he didn't think that the answer to everything was in economics. He said the problem is that God and conscience and morality, that's an illusion. Okay? The problem is not that we're suppressing the truth about God. The problem is that we're suppressing the truth about our sexual desires. And everything can be explained that way. Okay? He starts with, I don't know, I'm not going to know or give thanks to God. And then he ends up in the foolishness of thinking somehow through psychology and understanding our sexual whatever, we can understand ourselves and be fulfilled and be happy people. So with all the developments of psychology in the last 100 years, people must be a lot more contented and satisfied and happy than they used to be, right? No, they're not. They're worse. I've just quoted that. Someone says, you know what, I'm really not the gender that I was born with, I'm this under gender. If I can become that gender, I'll be happy and I'll be fulfilled. That's the foolishness that comes from rejecting God, and it leads to people committing suicide. It's that serious. Darwin is another one. Darwin said, I can explain the very creation of life, and we don't need to have God to do that. And that strikes very close to home if we look back at verse 20. The invisible attributes, the eternal power, and the divine nature have been clearly seen, being understood through what has been made. Darwin says, no. When we look at what has been made, it hasn't even really been made. It evolved, right? It evolved. That doesn't point to God. I'm not going to honor and give thanks to God. I'm going to propose this theory that explains life. To be fair to Darwin, when he came up with his theory, men didn't know a lot about genetics and molecular biology and organic synthesis. But in the 100 or more years since Darwin, we've learned a lot about that. I'm not an expert in it, but I do know and I have seen that when you go to people that know a lot about organic synthesis, about molecular biology, and people that know about it look at them and say, explain evolution to me. Really explain it. The answer invariably is, I don't have a clue. The people with the fossils seem to say they know how it is, but when you really get down to how it works, they don't have a clue. We've learned so much about the complexity of human life. Evolution as an explanation is foolish. You start from the premise that it's not God, you will end up in foolishness. That's just where it ends up. There is, among scholars of the last 100 years, though, one that is quite refreshing. And I don't have the quote, so I'm going to have to remember it. Alexander Solzhenitsyn. Alexander Solzhenitsyn was a Russian, served in World War II. He crossed the wrong person, and he ended up in one of the Russian political prisons. Spent many, many years there, suffered tremendously. He remembered his experience and began writing about them and got into more trouble. Eventually, he managed to get out of Russia. He's written volumes and volumes about the Russian Revolution and communism. And he gave an address, the Templeton Address, I'd recommend it to you. And in that address, he said, when I think about, and I'm paraphrasing now, kind of making it up as I go, but look it up, it's something like this. When I look back at what happened in the Russian Revolution, I want to try to explain it. I can't think of a better way of explaining than remembering when I was a young boy and I would talk to the older people in my village and I would say, how did this happen? How did this all come about? And they would say, men have forgotten God. That's why all of this happened. And then he goes on to say, you know, I've written volumes and volumes on this. He's dedicated my whole life as an historian studying the communist revolution and writing about it and what happened. And he said, and I come to the end of my life and someone says, explain to me what happened. And he says, I can't come up with any better explanation, anything more pithy, anything more to the point than what the old people told me when I was a young boy. And they said, men have forgotten God. To me, that is sort of the study of history coming to the conclusion that Paul revealed in chapter 1 of Romans. When men forget God, foolishness follows and evil, terrible things happen after that. And look at the world we live in today. I think we see it around us and we see it growing. I mentioned abortion, any number of things. I think we all are aware that we're not maybe so far from persecution of the church because men have forgotten God. Now, a downside to teaching from this section is there's an answer to that, isn't there? There is an answer to that, but it's not given explicitly here in Romans 1. You got to kind of keep going in the book to get to that answer. But I can't just leave it there. The good news is that one day, one like a son of man will come, and he will come up to the Ancient of Days and will be presented before the Ancient of Days. And to him will be given a dominion, glory, and a kingdom, that all the peoples, nations, and men of every language might serve him. And his dominion will be an everlasting dominion, which will not pass away, and his kingdom will not be destroyed. And as part of that, he will wipe away every tear from their eyes, and there will no longer be any death, there will no longer be any mourning, or crying, or pain. The first things will have passed away. So as ugly as it is, as much as we are witnessing maybe an increasing intensity of this spiral downward, we have a glorious hope, and it's more certain than anything we have. So those are my thoughts on Romans 1. Lord, we thank you and praise you for your grace, for saving us from the condition that Paul describes in Romans 1. Thank you for the certainty of your promises to us in that regard. Continue the work in us. Continue our sanctification, our growth, and continue to hold us up in the glorious hope that one day we will be with you and that seeing you, we will be like you. We look forward to that wonderful day. I thank you for the people that are here this evening. Thank you for the encouragement they are to me. Pray that we'll continue to be an encouragement one another as we live in a world that knows you but does not honor or give thanks to you. Thank you for the encouragement of fellow believers. Bless us, I pray, in Jesus' name. Amen.